this, or else why are we even doing this?
If I don't think I cut out all the fun stuff, because that to me is the fun stuff.
Build that audience, because if you've got no one to sell it to, then it's just going to flop and die, and no one likes a floppy, right?
I'm yet to meet a woman who just kind of grew up confidently in her body.
Welcome to my podcast. I'm Nicole Brumner. Join my weekly conversations with really interesting people as I delve into the stories and experiences that make them uniquely them. This podcast is a really special one because it is with my oldest guest, and that is Olive Roberts. She recently turned 94 and is still in fine form, as you'll see from her Instagram if you follow her there. She's got a really beautiful zest for life, which comes across in the podcast, and her active mind and unfussy approach to life is refreshing. She's overcome so much adversity, wars, tragedy with death, and she just has this really pragmatic approach to that. She's able to see the bigger picture. This is a lively and sophisticated account of a long life lived to the full. And I'm reading here from her book, which is called Stepping Stones, which you can purchase from Amazon. Olive's story is a remarkable one. Beginning in the northeast of England in the late 1920s, her life encompassed the aftermath of the First World War, the upheavals of World War II, and the unexpected post-war opportunity to travel and see the world. Born in Morpeth, Northumberland, in March 1928, her parents had suffered the hardships of a working-class upbringing, but at the time of her birth were happy and settled into family life. This was all about to change with the death of her father in 1934 of TB, the result of a chest weakened by a gas attack during World War I. Her mother married again, but after just 2 years she died while giving birth to twins. These children were adopted, and Olive was left as an orphan. As her story unfolds, with extracts from her husband's account of his war years and subsequent work for GCHQ, her resilience and optimism shine through, even as she moves away from her beloved northeast to explore the exotic shores of Malaysia, Hong Kong, and the Mediterranean. Her account is humorous and knowledgeable, casting light on the constraints of the 1930s, the fear and acceleration of the war, and eventually the chance to see the world and become immersed in cultures that a person of her background otherwise would have little access to. I'm sure you're really going to enjoy this conversation with the incredible Olive Roberts. Olive, do you believe that money can buy you happiness?
I think it goes a long way. Yes, it does. I think happiness and money don't really go together. I think you've got to have a middle road somewhere. Okay.
Yeah, no, exactly. And what about the whole concept of well-being and feeling good within yourself? And how do you think that fits in with happiness and prosperity more, the idea of being prosperous?
Oh, that's quite a question, isn't it, Nicole? How do I feel about that? I think the only way to prosper in life is to feel good. And if you don't feel good, you cannot prosper.
Yeah, I think what's interesting for me is that interviewing people in, say, their 20s and 30s, it's all about mindset and feeling good and making sure that they're happy with things. Whereas
what I've found, aren't we? Yes. Looking forward to the future, and nothing worried me. You know, you just got on with life, and things have hit you. You just had to get on with it. It's no good. Yeah, I was young once. Now I'm not. But I'm still just daft anyway. So there you go.
I think, though, that it seems that younger people now tend to be more concerned about things that make them feel good, whereas perhaps in years gone by, you didn't have that luxury. You had to just, as you say, get on with things and put food on the table and fulfill your responsibilities. Can you see that that's a change that's happened over the decades?
I think people talk about this, putting food on the table and this kind of thing. We were just the same. We were just exactly the same. We had this feel-good feeling. even though we hadn't very much money, just a meal on the table wasn't a worry. We just had, we hadn't it, we had something else. We had some packet of crisps or something, but we didn't expect luxuries. But it's only when you get older and you're working harder that you get the luxuries and they enjoy them.
There's a lovely story in your book, which I've got here, Stepping Stones. And you talk about how your grandmother would always save you extra dripping to put, I guess, some weight on your bones.
When I used to go and stand in the queue for free milk, I used to think, oh, I hope I get free milk. It was lovely to have this milk halfway through day at school with a straw in it, you know, nice and warm. And I couldn't have it. And I used to think, oh, this time they'll pick me out, you know. I must have been really fine. Sort of very healthy and, oh, there you go, you know. I was never going to get free milk. I think that explains it.
So with the free milk, was that something that they gave to children that they thought needed it?
Yes. Yes.
Interesting. Wow. So tell me about growing up. Obviously, it's interesting in your book you talk about your idyllic childhood, and by some accounts it was, but it was also very painful. But what is it that you view as being idyllic about your childhood?
I seem to have two childhoods. I had a childhood with my mother and a childhood with my father. Well, I had three childhoods, really, and then another childhood when I came to my grandmother when I was 8. I think they were all different in a way. When I was little, I just enjoyed being part of a family. Then my mother, you know, I get a little bit upset at this point. So, but with my grandmother, yes, it was lovely. Or as long as I came in, got washed, and I was fed, then that was it. I could do what I liked. And I knew everybody in the village, and everybody in the village knew me. So it was a halcyon childhood. Yes, it was.
Yeah, the bustle and the hustle and the love and the family around you just seemed very special, and something that perhaps children don't have now when they're so separated from their communities by the four walls in which they live in, and yet you had this freedom.
Yes, I did. I was very lucky in a way, wasn't I? Yeah, I agree with you there. Sometimes it's difficult because people move away and they're not part of a close family anymore, and that's very important.
And you've also experienced that as well with your moves abroad on various occasions.
Oh, yes. Yes.
You must have had such a pinch-me moment when you thought, here I am, I'm Olive Roberts from the north of England living in Singapore.
I'll tell you when I did feel it, and Ron as well, this big ship that came into Hong Kong where it was all dressed overall. And as we walked up the gangplank behind Lee Kuan Yew and Tunku Abdul Rahman, and Ron said, I'm not, and he said, oh, do you realize I'm going to shake hands with the Admiral? So from being a matlo, what do you call it, a matlo in the Navy? To be shaking hands with the Admiral was something really special. We just thought it was hilarious.
Yeah. No, these incredible stories. And so as you were growing up, how aware were you of money and how well off or not you were in your family?
Well, I always thought we were very well off. Apparently we weren't. My grandmother's on a pension and she had, I think, 7 and 6 for me. And not those days, you know, it didn't go very far then. And, I didn't realise. Money never came into it. I never, ever thought about it. I never was bothered with it. I went to school. I was the same as everybody else. And my friends were pretty much the same, except they had parents. I had my grandmother. But on the other hand, no, I wasn't any different to anybody else.
Yeah, and then you had the different experience of your mother remarrying and then going through that upheaval as well and then coming back. Yeah. And how aware were you then of money within that and financial well-being?
I never entered my head, no. Not at all, no. Not when you're 8.
Let's talk about your mother for a moment. And I know that this it can upset you, but I want to talk about your mother being such a maverick and she seemed like such a woman advanced, she seemed like a woman that was really ahead of her times with her health and fitness and with her ideas of what she wanted to do.
Yes. Oh, yes, she was really keen on health and fitness, doing all these exercises in the park, all those ladies with their shorts on. And yes, then she sent me to the open air school. I think that was because of my father dying of TB. I think she probably had a feeling that maybe I was vulnerable, I don't know. That was her idea anyway. Yeah.
And the idea was to expose you to the cold, strengthen you.
She used to clean her house so ridiculously. And as I can remember, very young, putting all the furniture in the yard, cleaning out the whole house inside. And then it was all put back again. She was one for cleaning and having everything. You know, everything had to be just so, yeah.
Hmm. And do you think that was due to her attitude towards TB and perhaps your vulnerability?
I think so, yes. I think her ignorance of the disease, probably. But my father was working in a hospital where there were a lot of TB cases anyway, just after the First World War.
And you talk about how your mother was sent away to work on a farm and lasted a day.
My grandmother was furious because she'd bought all these pinnies and whatever she had to have. I can't remember what it was. She bought all these. My mother, at one stage, which I didn't put in the book, at one stage when my grandmother used to move from farm to farm, my mother had sat the scholarship as it was in those days, I have no idea. And she had passed. And this teacher said, "Mrs. Arthur, would you leave Nellie with me? Because I think she could do very well." And my grandmother said, "Oh, no, we can't do that. We'd take her away." And I think my mother always talked about that. What I could have done, Mum, if you had left me here, I could have been brilliant. I could have been doing this and the other. But I think it all washed off on her. And she was very elegant, my mother. Very arrogant and elegant, yes.
Yeah, and it's interesting that she was in a time where women couldn't have it all. You had to choose what was your all that you had. And she was not able to have the career as a tailor that she wanted.
She did do a little bit of tailoring. Then she was stitching the aircraft wings up in the factory in Newcastle during the war. Yeah.
And how did that shape your attitude towards working in your first job that you took?
I don't know if she shaped me. It not shaped me at all, no. I just wanted to leave school and do something. I was growing up, you know, 14. In those days, 14 was 12 today, I should imagine. But I don't think so. I don't think after my mother died, I thought too much about her and still don't know a lot about her. I remember my father better. It's as if I sort of wiped her clean out of my mind.
Which is understandable, isn't it? The pain and the suffering that caused. So what was your first job and how did you go about securing that?
Well, my first job, the headmaster sent me down for an interview with this session. It's lovely. It's still there, actually, Books Fashions. It's still there in Sunderland. But at that time, it was the dress shop, you know. They kept the dress, put dresses in the window and the hats and everything. So he sent me down there to see, when I was 14, go down because they wanted somebody to do some work in the office. So I went. Didn't tell my grandmother about it at all. I went down. Oh, it was lovely. I loved it. There was sort of a Jewish firm. I think they called him Harvey Books. And I think there'd been a family firm in the area, in Durham, in that area for a long, long time. And they were lovely. They liked me and I liked them. So she said, "Do you want to start now?" And I said, "Yes." So I started. I started. When it got to Wednesday, which was half day every day, every week, it was Wednesday, was the half day in all the shops then. I don't know if it is now, I have no idea. But Wednesday came and I didn't know what to do with myself. I had a half a day, wandered around Sunderland and looked in the shops and everything, then went home and then went back. And on Friday, of course, they were open on Saturday, so I had to do something about it. So I can remember thinking, what am I going to do, especially when I got 15 shillings in my hand. I mean, 15 shillings in those days was quite a lot of money. Oh, 15 shillings, and what am I going to do? So I knew I'd have to tell her. I remember being absolutely terrified. and gave her this envelope of money.
When did you tell her?
Must have been when I came home at 6 o'clock. Time. Oh, she said, "What's this?" I said, "It's my wages. I've been working for a week." Oh, she said, "I have just been up to the post office and I've drawn out your allowance, 7 and 6 I've had to keep you here. And the police will be here. You're not allowed to do that if you're working." No, oh, she went crazy. So she said, next day, of course, she took me back to the shop. Well, she used to know the owner of the shop, the old Mr. Harvey Brooks, because he used to have a stall in the market years ago. He used to sell all the stuff for mourning clothes, you know, when people died. And he used to sell loads of material cheap. Then he sort of went into this business. My grandmother had followed him all this way. So when I got there, he said, "Oh, hello, Mrs. Arthur." I said, "Oh," she went mad. I said, "Oh, we like her. Just leave her, you know." No. I didn't spend all that money on education for her to work in hats. I was going to do anything like that. So then she took me down to this firm of solicitors. And that was my first job.
Can you remember how you spent your first few shillings that you were allowed to keep?
I can't even remember getting anything. I think I just got the bus fare. I don't think I ever got anything. I can't remember now. I don't remember that. So it mustn't have worried me.
No, exactly. Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, you talk about how you and Ron really struggled at times for money and the hours that you would put in and the him cycling through all sorts of weather to get to work. And when do you think when you look back at your life, at what point do you feel that you felt financially secure and felt like, okay, we don't have to worry anymore about paying the rent and putting food on the table?
When I stepped on the Himalaya to go to Hong Kong.
What was it about that was the turning point?
We suddenly gone from nothing suddenly to having a job. We were going abroad, we were going on an ocean liner, we were going to Singapore. We didn't have any money when we got on the ship, I might tell you. I had one dress. I think I maybe had two dresses. Ron had his wedding suit, which he wore with a bow tie. And we suddenly were risen up, you know, to the peerage almost. Oh, wow, look at this, you know, dinner in the evening. And yeah, it was fantastic. I think we got to Colombo or somewhere where we managed to get Ron had some money waiting, because that's what they used to do in the civil service. They had these places en route you could go to, and if you needed money or anything like that. And so we went, and Ron had some money due to him because we'd been on the ship for a month, really. I think it was about 6 weeks. I can't remember. It's quite a long time. Yeah. I remember that when we got to Gibraltar, going getting two nice dresses. But the Foreign Office had given us instructions that we had to have pure silk. So we'd gone from having nothing to suddenly being told that we had to wear pure silk, an evening dress every night for to go to dinner. So I think that's when my life changed.
And how did that change you, do you think? So your life had changed and you are now wearing silk.
I don't think I've ever changed. I think I'm just who I was then.
I think you're very unaffected by that change in your life. But you've got some beautiful stories about your time in Hong Kong and the jobs that you've taken. Is there anything that springs to mind immediately that you want to share? Obviously, there are many in your book.
I think maybe my time working for the 10th Gurkha Rifles and the Gurkhas in the headquarters in Burma. All the Gurkhas, yes. I think that was a time I really enjoyed. I found that all their, when they invited me to anything, how kind they were, how lovely they were. And I just loved the Gurkhas. I'm still looking for one, actually. I'm still looking for the ADC who worked with me. I don't know what happened to him, and I should imagine he's quite an old man now. I'd imagine he's quite be alive yet. I don't know if he's now or not. He was a Sandhurst trained officer, and he was wonderful. Yeah, we worked together really well.
Yeah, and what were you doing over? What were you doing over there? What was your role?
My role, I was PA.
Mm-hmm. Who were you PA to?
PA to the Deputy Commander of Land Forces.
Yeah,
that was my last job.
Mm-hmm.
I was a brigadier I was working for. Yeah. Do you know Hong Kong?
I do. Yes, I do. I've visited a couple of times.
Well, you know how difficult it is getting from Hong Kong Island over into the new territories.
So yes.
When going from the new territories into Hong Kong or going down was always difficult. You had to go over on the ferry and it was a hard time. So I was really, really pleased when one of these senior officers suddenly appeared and said, oh, I'm back now. I want an ADC coming with me, but I need a PA and you can come. So I went to work for him, which was lovely. So that meant that I was working in Hong Kong and living in Hong Kong. So that was perhaps the nicest time.
Mm-hmm. And how did you balance working with having three boys?
I don't know. I don't know. We just do it, you know. But yeah, I think so. You better ask them. I think that's the best.
I love that answer. As a mother of three, I love that because, you don't know. You just get on, don't you?
With three sons and a husband, I had a job to be feminine. Mm-hmm. I don't know about you, but eyes went to heaven, you know, if I brought anything feminine into the house, like a fancy lampshade or something. Oh, my God, you know. Yeah, I think you probably have that as well.
Yeah, I've got two boys and then a girl, so, yeah, it's...
Oh, you've got a girl. Well, that's lovely. When I've got a girl now, I've got Bella.
Yeah, exactly. Let's just go back to your childhood again, if we may. And I won't go too much into your childhood because I know it's upsetting and it's all in your book if people want to. But I think that there's a beautiful end of one of chapter two here, and I'll read it, and perhaps you can talk to me about how your life changed after this. But this was a lot of fun in the years leading up to 1939. But by the autumn of that year, this game would be consigned to history, and we had no idea when we would be playing it again. War had been declared, the blackout was in force, and all our lives would change dramatically over the next 5 years.
Yes.
Can you talk a bit about how dramatically your life did change over those 5 years?
I think it was exciting. I think everything was exciting and very different. And I think, as far as being frightened, no, I don't think any of us were worried. In fact, it became a joke, you know. Oh, gosh, the planes will be coming over. We'll have to go into the shelter. I think that's the British way of life. I think we do that. You know, I've got to go into Woolworths and get a thing to put around my wrist with my name on. Oh, isn't that lovely? You know, got to put one on the cat. We have to put one on the dog. And all these funny things that came out at that time. Oh, we're going to have gas masks. Oh, we've got ration books. Oh, I thought we're all free. You know, I thought you got this book and you just handed the tokens over. It was all free. Then you had this problem. Oh, we're going to have air raid shelters delivered. Oh, wow, that'd be lovely. We've got a big hole in the garden. So we took big holes in the garden and the air raid shelters. It was all exciting at the beginning. It was very different, but all exciting. And I think a lot of us, that part of it was more, how can I say, intense than what was actually happening in the War Office. You know, this was all food, there was suddenly a food office telling you what to eat and what you're going to have and how you could spend your sweet coupons. And well, this was very interesting. That was the first year. After that, we realized that we were really at war and that we very likely were going to be sitting in that air raid shelter, but pretty much as we were locked down.
Yeah.
Pretty much similar. We couldn't go out. And if you'd had an air raid the night before, then you didn't go to school. So we lost a lot of schooling. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the children today are very similar.
Yeah. No, I do think that there are a lot of parallels. And what interested me is right in the very beginning of your book, you talk about lockdown and you talk about your daughter-in-law, Bella, and who kept your spirits up during the first lockdown, making sure I had plenty to eat.
Yes, she did. And wonderful. I got so much I didn't order, which was rather nice. Things were pushed through, were they not, Bella?
Mm-hmm. And never failing to turn up with a glass of wine, especially on your 92nd birthday. And she came every week and has been a guiding light when I felt like giving it all up.
She did, yes. I was very, very lucky. I was one of the lucky ones.
Yeah. Yeah. I was really interested when I read that about your experience between the war and the air raid shelters and how that was and how you did compare that to lockdown and how much of that felt the same and how much of that felt different. Obviously, there are a number of years apart between the two and your life has changed, but what were some of the parallels that you could see between the two events?
I think the parallels were that we were all very frightened of the war eventually. At first we weren't. It's exactly the same as this pandemic, really. We weren't really frightened in the beginning until it started to hit us, that people were in hospital and they were dying of it. Before that, it was just, we've got this coming on. It was exactly the same with the war at first. Oh, isn't it fun? We've got all this air raid charges. We've got this. We've got air raid wardens and what have you. But then it suddenly hits you. I think that's pretty much the parallel.
Yeah, it was interesting to me that you have such a strong outlook on some of the loss that you've experienced in your life, and you just get on with it. And you even said that in one point of your book that you've had some bad things happen, but you just
get on with it. Well, there's nothing else to do. You can't sit down and cry, can you? Just get on with it. I'll tell you one very funny thing. You know, in the book I wrote about being in the air raid shelter and this little baby in there? Yes. Yeah. Little Jim? Well, little Jim's wife got in touch with me. So little Jim is now 86. Little Jim says, thank you very much. He's now 86. But writing a book is an amazing thing, how many people it touches over the, you know, you don't realize it, you're writing a book, but how many people it touches over the years.
Yeah. And have you had many people contact you?
All the time. They're still contacting me now, yes.
So you talk about just getting on with things and not letting unfortunate situations get you down. And you've taken up painting more recently, and which is quite incredible given your eyesight, is it not? And your paintings are beautiful. So how did you get started in painting? What led to that?
I think it was in Cyprus. Then I was at I had no family there with me, and I was on my own. Ron was working away quite a lot of the time because he was on with the Blueberries right on the border, you know, with northern Cyprus and so wherever we were. And I just had to find something to do. So I sort of went along with a lot of ladies who played golf, and of course they also went to a painting class, but some of them were army wives. So they'd be using the army, things that were provided by the army. So they took me along. I remember the first painting was a cat. It was awful. I thought it was wonderful. But then when I came home, I kept it up. And I did a lot of painting when I was living in Chard. I used to go down into Devon, and we used to have weekends and quite a long time staying away with painting groups. And then my eyes started with my eyes. So I found it difficult. For a long time, I didn't do any painting. You know what? There's a lot of people like myself who have very low sight and some who actually have no sight. But I don't think the painting comes from the eyes. I think it comes from the brain. I think it's there inside. And I think, I can't tell you how I do it, but I find great satisfaction in finishing a picture.
And then having them hang on the walls of your lovely yes. daughter-in-law's home.
On the wall, yes. Not for very long, because people come and say, oh, I like that. Some people who are living near me at the moment, yeah, they come and say, oh, I like that picture, so can I have it? Mom, yes. I just paint another one. Yeah.
Tell me about Ron, your husband. You've got a lovely story about how you met and then met again. Can you share that story with us?
Yes. I don't know how old I was. I tried to work out how old I would be. I suppose 15, 16, just past that age group. And I used to help my aunt when these mothers' union things that she used to hold, whisk drives and dances. It's all in the book. And this whisk drives and dances, I used to go and help her, you know, doing the dishes and what have you. She was lovely, my mother's sister. She lived next door to us. So we sort of joined together, my grandmother, and she was the passage. So we've sort of a long bungalow with a middle, you know what I mean?
Yes.
For all there were separate bungalows, they were all joined by a passage. So I said, I was just standing watching the dancing, really, when this sailor came up and asked me if I'd like to dance. I think I actually asked my Auntie Belly, is it all right if I get up to dance? It's the first time I'd ever been asked to dance. I didn't even know if I could dance. I had no idea. I said, oh, yes, pet, go on, enjoy yourself. That's lovely. So I did. And then he said, could you take me home? I thought, well, this is tricky. He only lived three doors down from the manage hall. And I didn't think that's tricky. It never entered my head. I just said, is it all right if it takes me home? She said, oh, yes, pet, go on, enjoy yourself. So I did. I went out and I walked straight past my friends. I just, do you know, I didn't do it on purpose. We were just talking. I can't explain it now. Just talking. And we just walked in. He said, where do you live, by the way? He looked at me as if I'd gone off my rocker. Yeah. So that was how I met Ron, really. And then I sat on the wall chatting. And my grandmother came out like this black white penny and this thing. Get in the house. No sitting on walls. It come to my bad end. So I thought I'd never see Ron again. Amazing that I saw him come into that dance hall.
And then you did. You did see him again.
You know, I think. Yeah. Because I think he was away for 3 years. I think it was about 3 years after, so I must have been, 15, 16? I must have been nearly 18.
And did he recognise you instantly after 3 years, or did you recognise him?
Oh, I knew him. Yes, I saw him when he came in. I knew it was him. And he still has a turn the sailor uniform. So I went up and I said, would you ask? He got this girl up. Now, she's one of the girls in the hall that nobody ever danced with. You know, one of these ones. I was dancing with her for, you know. She wasn't in with the in crowd. I was in with the in crowd. We were the in crowd. She wasn't one of us. So I thought, oh, I didn't mind. If it had been a friend, I wouldn't have done it. I just walked out and excused her. She just walked off. And he looked so amazed. I don't think he'd ever been excused or anybody had ever tried to get a dance with him before. I think he was quite, oh, wow, this is something, you know. Yeah, no idea who I was, no, not at all, no. Not even when he took me home, no.
So he then took you home, and so he didn't click then that it was the same house?
No, and I never talked. I kept saying, he said, should I? I think he looked a bit, should I remember you? Yes, you should. It wasn't until he got home, I think, that he realised that where he'd left me off was that cottage, and they walked across the road and got the bus. I think it suddenly dawned on him, yeah.
But you must have made an impression on him because you were married.
How old do you reckon?
How did that come about?
Well, I don't know, really. I think, because I had a boyfriend at the time, it was a bit tricky. Yeah, things were a bit tricky at that time, so.
Yeah. Oh, that's lovely. And you went on to have three children, three boys, as you say.
Mm-hmm.
What are their names?
Colin, Gordon, and Nigel.
And Nigel, okay. And, yes, Nigel's the one, the baby.
In America. Colin lives in Cheltenham and Nigel is here. Actually, Nicole, sounds an interesting book. You've made it sound.
It is an interesting book. And
I found somebody saying these lovely things about it. I can't believe it, you know.
No,
I
there's just
family, really. Mm-hmm.
Well, you wrote it for your family, didn't you? And then all of a sudden other people have started reading it.
Yes, and social history it's called now. Mm.
Yeah. How long did it take you to write the book?
Oh, going into 2 years, I think, by the time it was finished and published. Most of the pandemic, I was sort of held up with it. It was really ready to go to press at that time, but we had to sort of hold up. So over 2 years.
And is it something that you would recommend other people do, to recount their life experience?
I don't recommend that other people do things that, because you've written a book, that other people want to write a book. I think it's cathartic. I think it's very good. And I think also it's made me a lot of friends online. People are very interested, still very interested, you know. And I'm still got, a lot of emails, and it's sort of filled my life, yeah.
Yeah. Have all your family read the book?
Yes, yes.
All of them?
All okay. of them. Yes, they've all read it, I hope. Have they all read it? I hope so. If they haven't, they've got it there, and they can give it to their children. That's the idea, that perhaps two or three generations ahead, it will be interesting, more interesting than it is now, really, as to how we were living.
Mm-hmm. Let's go right back to the beginning, if I may. And obviously I know the answers to this because I've read your book. But where were you born and when?
I was born in Morpeth. I don't know if you know Morpeth. It used to be the capital of Northumberland at one time, but it isn't now. I think that's been moved to somewhere else. But Morpeth is a sort of a country town right on the borders. Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Beautiful.
When were you born?
1928.
It's interesting with women, isn't it? Because there's a point in time where it's okay to ask you how old you are, and later on it's okay to ask you how old you are. And then there's this big period of time in the middle where it's not okay to ask someone how old they are.
Absolutely, that's true. The thing is, where I am now in this apartment block, I think there are about eight of us born in 1928. We call us the 1928ers. There's one lady in there, she's 101, and she's fabulous, still going strong. It's amazing how many of us there are, you know?
Yeah. Well, there must be something in the water there if there are so many of you still doing incredibly well and at 101.
Yeah. She should write a book because when she was in, instead of going into the services, she was drafted onto the railways. And she was a guard in London, one of the trains. Yeah. On the trains in London, on the underground and whatever.
Yeah. Where would you consider home to be now after all these places you've lived?
If I look back on it, maybe, you'll not believe this, but maybe Hong Kong.
Yeah, and that was the last. When was the last time you visited Hong Kong?
I can't remember when we left Hong Kong. I think we did three tours there? I think we did about, this could have been about three, well, did one, 3 years, about 4 years in Singapore. Then back home, then a tour in Hong Kong. I think we did two tours in Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
So that was 2 years in Hong Kong.
What was it that took you abroad? Was it Ron's work?
Yes, he was posted abroad. Wherever there was trouble, we were there.
What was it he did?
He was a radio operator.
And what does that mean?
Well, it was a bit secret. It's a very secret service because when he came out of the Navy, one or two of them were called back because they needed radio operators at that time to start up a new service, which was going to be post office radio. So when he came, but they asked him if he'd like to join post office radio. He was a very, very good radio operator. I mean, that was, he loved it. He loved it. And he was very clever with Morse. And he said, I think I've put my name down to go and join the post office radio. So that's what he thought it was. Mm-hmm. So when he went for the interview down to London, which they sent him warrants, and he was going up and down, and he'd had a lot of tests, and he did all these things. He came back, he said, "Oh, I think I've signed the Secrets Act." He said, "Yeah, I know. It's frightening, isn't it? I signed the Secrets Act." And it wasn't until, I suppose, when he got the first warrant to send him up to Cooper, Laura in Scotland, to the secret radio station up there, that we suddenly realised that what we'd let ourselves in for, really.
Yeah.
But he loved it. He loved his job. He's very clever, too.
Was it lonely at times when you were posted abroad and you were by yourself?
On work shift, so it was some night shift day. You know, I used to have to put a thing behind the fridge to know when he was coming in, when he was going out. You know, he was working these shifts and half shifts. You know, 8 to 1 and then 9 to 2 and overnight shifts and day. Yes, I got used to it.
And you seem to live a very active life now.
Never lonely. I always had people around me. Always had I made a lot of friends.
Yeah, you seem to be very adventurous.
We're all wives together. You know, so we did things as well, you know, on our own, because we had a shift. They had a shift pattern. And if you were on this certain shift, A shift, B shift, all the wives stayed together. And we had things, we got for meals and coffees. And it wasn't lonely. You know, it's a fantastic life, really. Spent most of the time in the Singapore Swimming Club. Oh, it's fabulous. No, I loved it. I wasn't working. It was lovely. Kids were enjoying life. Yeah. I still did guides. I was always doing guides.
I was going to ask about that. You've been very involved in guides all your life. How did that start?
Well, it started with the brownies, didn't it? Yeah. Start with the brownies. Then from the brownies up into the guides. And just always been interested in guides. When my children were little, you know, small, no, I didn't do guides. But once I got older and they were doing cubs and things like that, I got drafted back into guides again. And I'll tell you a lovely thing. One lady sent me an email saying, you know, Olive, I'm reading your book now and it's a funny thing, but I'm hearing my grandma's voice. I thought that was one of the nicest compliments she could have paid me.
Yeah. No, that is beautiful. Yeah. No, your story really resonates, I guess, because my grandmother got married at 16 and couldn't do the job that she wanted to do, but had to go and work the farm and had an interesting, there are not many parallels, but there are some, although she's Australian, obviously,
I think probably she's like me. Her father was probably in the First World War, and I think the hard times were hard. I mean, my father would be 3 years in France, 5 years in France, I think, when he came home. So that he went back into education. He had no parents. His brother was killed in the war. My aunt was killed in the war. She was a nurse. And she was killed on one of these casualty stations. And he came back, and I think he couldn't go down the pit where he was training to be an electrician. He couldn't do that because he was gassed. So he went back into education, and then he trained to be a nurse. He did 4 years nurses training within this lunatic asylum in Mobbeth, which I think it's called now St. George's Hospital, but that's what it was then. And there were a lot of people in there, you know, with injuries from the First World War, you know, in this hospital. And then he didn't get married till he was about 28. So like your mother. And we kind of suffered from the First World War. That's all I can say. The results of the First World War came out in our generation.
Yeah, the other story that I found really interesting was shooting sparrows to eat, and that's something that my grandfather did.
Yes. I thought nobody would believe that, because I didn't believe her when she was telling me. But, yes, they used to put them on a stick and roast them at the fire. It just shows you how we don't know what it is to be really, really poor. We have no idea, really, because we're not. None of us now, with this marvelous government we've got, that we ever have to go down our bended knees to ask for things. And I think that's important. But I think they did. You know, I can remember my grandmother would not have the doctor. Not. I think she'd have to be dying before she, because you had to pay for this doctor. And I think she used to pay tuppence a week or something for her. They used to collect money for the doctor's fund, what that was. When this marvelous health service came, wow, it was wonderful, you know. But even then, she wouldn't send for the doctor. You know, when I was having that miscarriage, she wouldn't send for the doctor. Oh, no, 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 no. Don't want to bother the doctor about these things. And when the doctor came, you know, into the house, she always had a glass of whiskey on the table, especially for him, you know. He's a Scotsman. Glass of whiskey on the table, especially for him. It's a different world, Nicole. You've no idea.
No, absolutely. And things like running around with no shoes on in the cold. And there was the beautiful quote about the lady asking your grandmother, did you have a nice Christmas? And she said, what's Christmas?
She told me that. I said, well, what's Christmas? I don't know.
Yeah.
How do you equate all these different generations? If you think that I was stretching a generation. I was with my parents who were modern, very modern. My mother was very modern, my father. And stretching to this lady who had to walk to take groceries out in her bare feet and, you know, she had two standards of education. That would be two terms. Mm-hmm. So she learned learned to read. Right. She could read, I think, but she used to get all her spellings wrong. So she'd look through the newspaper, through the Evening Chronicle, till she found the word, and then she found how you spelled it. And I thought, she was quite clever, really.
Mm-hmm. It's very clever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I wonder, when people romanticize about the good old days, whether they really know or remember correctly what the good old days were like.
I mean, to her, it's absolutely normal to have a bucket of water in a cupboard, because there was no water in this bungalow. Well, it was a farm cottage, really. There was no water. And I used to have to call onto this tap. Me, I thought I was being really badly done to. When I look back now, I think, poor soul. I expect, why didn't my grandmother get this? Oh, I have to stand here getting this water in this bucket. I can remember Ron coming to the house once and coming through. My grandmother must have been out, I can't remember, coming through into this little pantry, and he said, what's that? I said, it's our water. He said, water? Is that what you... Oh, I said, yes, that's for drinking. That's for making drinking water. He looked and he said, oh, that looks a bit grubby in there. I thought, maybe it did. I had no idea. But you just took all this for granted. Eventually, I thought... Also, she probably thought that was quite up to date and modern, you know. She had the water in the house and she had a gas cooker which had no bottom in. She used to just throw a match in occasionally. She'd come out with all her eyebrows all singed up here. She had this gas cooker. But mostly the stuff was on this big stove. You know, she used to cook everything there. Lovely bread would be rising when I'd come in. I mean, I had a lovely childhood, really. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not knocking it.
You said a couple of times, and I want to get your quote here. You said a couple of times, and you said it twice in one chapter, actually, which I found really interesting. You said that children's feelings were not considered. They just got on with it.
Yeah.
And how do you think that – do you think it's a good thing that that's changed? It sounds like you do.
I do. I used to think my mother was under the bed, you know. I had no idea where she'd gone. I know it sounds funny to you, but really, nobody told me. Nobody talked about anybody that had died. They didn't talk about them anymore. It was as if they just disappeared off the face of the earth. Nobody ever told me, no. So maybe that's what I was thinking about at the time when I wrote that.
Yeah.
I think that children were seen and not heard, you know.
And now you've got three children and how many grandchildren?
Seven, I think, haven't I? Oh, I lost Helen this year. I lost one of my grandchildren this year. Mm. So that was sad. I think I have six now.
Six grandchildren.
And they're wonderful. Absolutely love them.
Yeah, it's. I guess it's a blessed life. A blessed life now looking back, although at times it's certainly had its challenges.
Well, I'm glad I wrote the book. I wouldn't have done it if my son hadn't kept saying to me, you should write all this down, you know, Mum. I said, oh, yeah, I know, I should write it down. I'd like to write it down. And he really made it possible for me to write the book. And for that, I'd always be grateful, really.
And is that Nigel that did that?
Nigel, yes.
Yeah. Oh, dear, Olive, and you're incredibly strong, not just mentally, but physically. What do you think? People always want to know, what do you think it is that's given you this strength, this physical and mental strength?
I don't feel any different to anybody else. I can't think that I'm any different to some of my friends. Most of them, you know, after a lot of friends of my own age. And another thing, of course, living where I am, I'm living alongside people who are in their 70s, 60s. It'll be 60s and 70s in these McCarthy and Stone homes. And they're all with me. It's fun, you know? And if I don't want to join in everything, they come and get me. And it's just very interesting living with a load of people who are younger than me and some older than me. And every day brings some new challenge. And I think that's very important as you get older. And I think you've got to be one jump ahead of this business of slipping down somewhere and banging your head. You've got to be with it. And a lot of people aren't. I'm not saying they're any different to me, but they aren't, but I am. And I don't know why. But you tell me, Nicole.
I think that you've got an incredible attitude where you, and this is just from reading your book, obviously, where you, I don't think you suffer fools, but I think you also don't allow yourself to wallow in any way. It seems that you've just got this, right, Olive, get up and get on with it.
Yes, I have. I talk to myself a lot now. I don't know whether I'm living on my own. Tell myself off, yeah. I do my exercises and, I do talk to myself a lot. I'm getting a bit worried about that, actually. and I talk to Alexa, which is rather nice. Yeah, she's fun. She knows an awful lot. She knows an awful lot more than I do, so I'm happy to talk to Alexa.
What exercises do you do?
Oh, I generally watch that program in the morning, every morning. There's people sit and there's one sits in a chair and I've got it on BBC One, I think. And they used to have a lot of people on from Strictly, you know, in the mornings doing exercises. Yeah, jump up and down, walk up and down. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, whatever you're doing is working beautifully for you, Olive, because you are just radiant and strong and you're incredibly inspirational. And I don't want to throw that word around.
You have to have a sense of humour.
Yeah.
My father used to say that all the Arthur family have had a perverted sense of humour, and I think maybe that's true. Yeah, could be.
Oh, indeed. Well, Olive, thank you so much for your time. I think we're going to get, well, I know we're going to get a beautiful podcast out of this, and we'll edit it and make it lovely and just put together something that I hope you're pleased with.
Oh, that's lovely. Well, it's very kind of you, Nicole, to go to all this bother. I do appreciate it, and I have enjoyed your company.
I've seen it completely, and they've done a great job kicking off.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please support us with a like, comment, subscribe and share. And you can always join the conversation live across my YouTube, Facebook and LinkedIn pages at 1 p.m. every Thursday. See you there soon.